Communication networks is another term for organizations. An organization can be described as a communication network. By organization, then, I mean any kind of a communication network. And this may be, for instance, the organization of your own relationships, which are defined by your own communicative behavior. To whom do you talk? When? Directly or through someone else? By what means? Personally or over the phone or by letter? Talk. I don't mean to limit it to talk, but to communicate in any form. In general, communication is to the social sciences, in my opinion, what energy is to the physical sciences. What the social sciences are about is very largely communication at bottom. For instance, Wiener, in one of the books that you have on your list, The Human Use of Human Beings, has some very interesting things to say about this. He says that it is the thesis of this book that society can only be understood through a study of the messages and the communication facilities that belong to it, to the society. He says again, the process of receiving and of using information is the process of our adjusting to the contingencies of the outer environment and of our living effectively within that environment. Well, I could go on all afternoon, of course, quoting from various persons who are sensitive to the fundamental role of communication in organized society or in the ordinary human interrelationships which we all share. Now, a society, including a world society, a neighborhood, and the organizations within it, patterns of human relationship within it can all be studied as communication networks. A communication network can be observed by following the movement of messages from one point in it to another point in it. For example, just to tune us into this a bit more, A company receives orders for goods. A company makes hairpins, bobby pins, toothbrushes, anything. It receives an order. The order can be followed from the point of reception all through the plant, from person to person, from relay station to relay station, within the plant. There will be copies made of it, and they will go along their routes. One goes into the file, and one goes to the shipping clerk, and etc. These routes converge eventually. Finally, the toothbrushes or whatever it is are packaged, or they already have been, and they're addressed, and then they leave the plant by a certain route and go out to an address outside. Now, by studying the number of instances of such messages as they move through a plant, one can define very well the operations of a business, a plant, and much of what we mean by management is concerned with the design and the understanding and the improvement and the operation of these communication networks through which messages flow. You can think of this, to make just one more statement to tune us in, you can think of this in terms of yourself. You are a relay station, or a source, or possibly a terminal point for messages. You are a relay station within a network through which messages move. And you play a part in this, in that you may change the messages, you may hold them up, you may speed them on, you may redirect them, and so on. So your own living can be described in good part in terms of the way you function in the communication networks within which you function. Now let me simply draw a diagram here. I'll make it kind of small. This is an organization. It's as old as Rome and beyond. But it's still essentially the pattern of organization that you find today, even in the most advanced of our organizations. We seem to have been blocked somewhere back 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. And we've had almost no inventiveness since when it comes to human organization. Even the very most advanced research organizations, there's still a pattern essentially like this. These are departments or divisions. These are the levels at which people work or function. And these are the headships of the departments, and I separate them a little because there's a gap there to be jumped. And this is the directorate, the president or the board of directors or the executive committee or whatnot. And there are certain things that you can say about an organization just on the basis of this little diagram. Messages travel vertically much more than horizontally. In fact, in most organizations, there is very little horizontal movement of messages. And there are some in which, at some levels, there is no communication horizontally. You can say that, you can observe that as a message moves up from a lower level to a higher level within a department or division of the organization, it tends to become briefer. There is loss of detail. It's like the abstracting process as it passes through the relay stations. Messages which begin as 2-hour discussions or 10-hour discussions or 6 months discussions, thousands, maybe millions of words, end up at the top levels very often as simply 50-word memos. There is tremendous loss in detail, in the information that is carried. Coming down, you have the same thing. But on the whole, messages move down much more easily than they move up. And it is particularly interesting to observe the feedback from lower to higher levels and vice versa. That is, how much return message is there. Now, I think we're tuned in enough to know what it is we're talking about. I want to put here now some of the problems of communication in terms of the context that we're talking about. Problems of communication. And they can be roughly sorted out or talked about under these headings. There's sending and receiving. There is a message. There is the code are the symbol system, the language used for composing the message, and there is a situation, and this may be talked about as the network we've been talking about, or the organization, or the situation within which the messages are going to be developed from the code, by means of the code, and sent and received. And the sending and receiving aspects of this, we're particularly interested in, well, let's be, before I talk about that, I have another way to talk about problems. The network, the communication network traffic, we can, this terminology is partly my own, and if it sounds unfamiliar, that's because it is. I think, for the most part. We can describe the traffic within the network in terms of the amount of information that flows. The rate of the flow of that information, the direction of the flow, that is, the pattern of flow, and then the attenuation or the loss, this word means loss, attenuation is a loss, attenuation of hearing, you know, loss. Of information as it flows from relay station to relay station, from person to person, that is. The accretion, it isn't just loss, but things get added as the message moves along the way. And distortion, that is, what does get moved on may not be moved on in the same form in which it was received at a given relay station. Or by a given person, if I think we probably might refer to. Can you read that? If you have to stand up, I go ahead. Now, with regard to the sending and the receiving, we're particularly interested in the blockage, that is, attenuation or loss or restriction of flow or of communication can amount to a blockage. There, persons may be characterized by the amount of information they send, the amount of talking they do, if you like, to other people. And there are persons who don't talk much. And in an organization, there may be a manager of a division who has a policy of being very tight-lipped. And he says nothing but what he has to say after he has made decisions. This is one type of a manager. And it goes far. This kind of a manager goes far to define the atmosphere of the situation and the communicative behavior, to determine the communicative behavior of other individuals in the system. Other managers are very talkative and very free in expressing their feelings, and they telegraph their decisions days and weeks ahead by sounding out people about them. And this creates another type of situation with another kind of communicative behavior on the part of nearly everyone involved. In a sense, the blockage of communication is the basic disorder of communication, the basic problem, the rate of flow, the amount of information. These are the two very fundamental dimensions of communication problem. These are the basic aspects of the communicative behavior of the individual, of yourself. The amount of information that you send and the rate at which you send it. Now, there's a very interesting kind of problem here. I think what we're going to do on January the 7th, is that we're going to hear a tape. And on the 9th, we're going to talk about it, because I don't think you can help talking about it. And it will be fascinating to discuss it, having studied general semantics as much as you have up to now. This is a tape of which there are thousands of copies, they tell me. It was a speech originally by a psychiatrist at a meeting in San Francisco some years ago. I don't know exactly what the date was. I got the impression it was 2 or 3 years ago. I got this from the Army the other day. The psychiatrist had been assigned to study the prisoners of war, American prisoners of war, who had been taken prisoners in the Korean War by the communists, and they had been presumably brainwashed. Anyway, they had been managed in a certain way. And his assignment was to investigate whatever this was. And he did this in various ways, including some depth interviewing of the men involved after they returned. He makes a talk about the findings and the meanings of the findings as he sees them, and then winds it up by reciting the code of conduct, which the military forces developed after this experience they had with their own men who were taken prisoner in Korea. I think you'll have no difficulty listening to this. It'll hold your interest from beginning to end. And I can't imagine anybody who had heard it not doing an awful lot of thinking about it. And I think you would be most interested to find out how others think about it. So I don't think we should have the tape without having an opportunity for you to talk about it among yourselves. Because part of what he's concerned with is the situation in which you might want to restrict communication. What kinds of situations are these? Ordinarily, communication blockage would be pathological, a problem, you see. I say ordinarily, or would you argue with that, perhaps? You think there is some kind of an optimal amount and kind of communication among people. I think this tape will get you to thinking about this as perhaps you never have before. It isn't a simple matter, obviously. In ordinary discourse, in ordinary relationships, we have taboos. We have what we call good taste. We don't say everything. We don't indulge in complete freedom of speech. And we don't print everything. We do have various kinds of censorship. Most persons resist certain forms of it. And there are times when, for instance, you might wonder whether a doctor should tell the truth to a patient, and so on. Well, I think this is just so engaging, so terribly important to think about that we'll come back to it after the holidays, unless something else develops that looks more important, but I don't think so. But there are many conditions under which, and many of these are what we would probably think of as ordinary everyday conditions, under which the basic communication problem would be that involving a blockage of communication, both on the sending and the receiving. That is, a person who refuses to listen is interfering with the flow of information, you see, with communication. Or the person who will listen only to what he finds agreeable. Or the person who is distracted and just doesn't listen, not because he has anything against what the speaker is saying, but he's just preoccupied with something else. There are various kinds of ways to study this. The conditions under which communication tends to be blocked is a major research program, of course, and this would include everything from the effects of drugs to the effects of executive orders and other kinds of conditions. Under the heading of the message, we're especially interested in the clarity and the validity of messages. And something else, it's a little hard to find a single word for, but let's use the word style. We react differently to two different messages that would be equally clear and equally valid, but one of them is rather poetic and the other is rather prosaic or harsh, in as we would feel it. There's something that we can call style or whatever else you would like to call it, aside from the clarity and the validity. With regard to the code, we've already done a good deal about this in the course. The main consideration here is the structure of the language, the kinds of things you are able to say with it, the categorical nouns, the nature of the verbs, the kinds of relationships that can be expressed. You remember our discussion of the transitive verb, the one-way relationship kind of verb that makes it very difficult to talk about interactions, which are what we nearly always have to talk about. And finally, the situation. Now here we're interested in a great many things. This is the network again. We're back in the communication network. And let's take a look at it. Communication networks differ with regard to size and complexity. Within a network, any one route may be long or short. It may take a long time or a short time to receive or to send a message. The number of persons involved, or the relay stations, if you want to use a more mechanistic language, will differ from one network to another. And the arrangement of the relay stations, or the arrangement of the persons, as in this kind of an organizational scheme that I have up here on the board, they're arranged in layers, levels, hierarchies. And this is a very common kind of organization. Common kind of arrangement of persons.
a class society. Of course, all societies are probably class societies, to some degree at least, but societies differ with regard to the number of levels of status and authority and the rigidity with which they keep their relationships to each other. But characteristically, in most organizations that we know about, have departments, divisions, sections, some kind of units. It can be diagrammed like this, or within departments you can have subunits. Now I want to spend the rest of the time today talking about a major problem that arises out of this. And I suppose it would ordinarily be called departmentalism. A general statement of it is that there is a blockage of horizontal communication in an organization. And we call this departmentalism. That is, the English department does not talk, the people there don't talk much to the members of the history department, for example, in any official way, in any way that matters to the organization. Now, they may talk with each other at the lunch counter, compare meteorological observations, or exchange tips on the next race, but they are not as members of an organization communicating with each other. And this can be carried to the point where there is a disintegration of the organization. If you observe very many universities, now it's kind of hard to observe a university, but as I have visited many universities to talk or consult or do something there, I have met with people who are identified with some part of the university, and it's usually a department or a college or a center or a laboratory, some organization within the organization. And it is rather obvious in some instances that the people within the organization apparently don't have much to do with each other. I was at a meeting the other day in college, and lo and behold, this was in a big city, lo and behold, I was introducing people to each other who had been working there for years in this organization. They were in the same department, mind you. And I was amazed. I found that there were a number of these persons who hadn't met each other, or they had, it had been so long ago, and it was at somebody's wedding or something, and they didn't really remember. So an organization can get so disintegrated in terms of the lack of communication within it that the network practically rots away. There's nothing left but a lot of individuals standing around. There used to be relay stations, but the connections have come loose. Sort of like a telephone system, and there's nothing there now but the poles. Now, it doesn't usually go this far, but there is a degree of this kind of disintegration of organizations in the form of departmentalism that is, I think, so great that it amounts to one of our major problems, not only nationally, but internationally. That is, the disintegration of relations among nations is this kind of thing that we're talking about, too. That is, nationalism is a part of the same disease, is a form of the same disease, as departmentalism is a form of. The failure of communication in some degree, where the failure has some kind of consequence that affects individuals and organizations. Now, within a corporation or a university or other organization, this kind of departmentalism, this failure of communication horizontally, the tendency for all the communication to be in the vertical lines and none horizontally, the tendency in this direction, which I am calling departmentalism. This tends to result in a number of consequences, such as waste, as a duplication of effort, for example. Every laboratory, every clinic in the organization, every department, every part of a department may become so isolated that each one hires its own secretarial staff. And half the secretaries are sitting around doing nothing. But each one must have a secretary. This becomes a status thing. The organization breaks up into little tiny islands, each one totally equipped for housekeeping, you see. I may have mentioned, as it's a kind of a striking example, in General Electric, the corporation, General Electric, I used to know this by heart, but it's something like this. There's 120 departments, divisions, and each of these has, I don't know how many departments, and there's a tremendous amount of duplication. I remember it was Hot Point, which was a section of General Electric. Hot Point was divided up into five departments: electrical appliances and refrigerators and stoves, and I forget what the others were called. Before they did this, they had a financial department, you know, bookkeeping and whatnot. And it employed 300 people. After they broke it up into five departments, they had 550 people working in finance. This is enormously wasteful. If you're thinking of business either for a corporation or for a nation in world trade, if you're thinking of it competitively, this is deadly. If you're thinking of it in education, in a university, and you're wondering about where the money is going to come from to run a university, this kind of duplication of effort, duplication of function, becomes terribly expensive. And there aren't enough tax dollars to go around for this sort of thing. I think it's rather interesting that in the effort to save money, we don't usually look at this, at the matter of the communication network, the organizational structure as defined by communication network. This is what happens, you see, when communication breaks down. The way to avoid all this duplication is to keep communication effective. And then you find that you don't need all of these isolated places, all these isolated stations. You can pool people or organizational units that are in communication with one another. Find ways to pool their resources and to cooperate in getting work done. It creates tension for the individuals who are working in the organization. Kind of unproductive competitiveness within the organization. In any university, for example, there is a limited amount of money for anything, things like equipment. And there is a tremendous lot of competition among the various departments for the available typewriters or the available anything, available desks and chairs, lights and whatnot. And there's one kind of an administrator who builds himself up like a pack rat. He gathers unto himself all the equipment he can. He sort of sits on it. He's a great man. Well, this gets very wasteful when communication breaks down, and it makes for bad relationships. People resent this sort of thing. I suppose one of the worst examples of this is the continuing fight for floor space, for square footage in all organizations, universities and hospitals. You assign a room to a department, and boy, it's going to take all the king's horses and all the king's men to get it back again if you need it for something else, because it's theirs. And they get possessive in the name of their departments, you see, each person. And this makes for constant friction. The amount of time devoted by highly trained persons persons who have gone to college for 19 or 20 years, I mean gone to school, 15 or 20 years, they have all the degrees there are, and they've had much experience, and they are now ready to be very creative. What are they doing? They're fighting over floor space. They're fighting over typewriters. They're writing complaints to the deans or the president, the provost, or whoever is to get it because the wage scale in their department is not up. Somebody else is paying more for assistance, and they're getting them all. And this is it's a terrible waste of highly cultivated persons who, because they are highly cultivated in our kind of a system, happen to land in these very responsible administrative positions. This we could look at for the rest of the winter. Have you ever stopped to wonder where we get people for administrative positions? You know where you get doctors, you train them. They go to medical school, and then they become doctors. That's how you get lawyers and chemists and speech pathologists and audiologists and psychologists. But administrators? Where do you get administrators? If you were to get all the administrators of the University of Iowa together in one room, that would be one of the most heterogeneous groups you've ever seen. Now, without mentioning names, there's... Well, that wouldn't add anything. Starting with our own department, there's a phonetician being an administrator. Go over to the English department, one of the largest organizations in the whole state of Iowa. Who runs this? What training? He's a wonderful guy, one of my best friends. But I'm talking about administration. He prepared himself for this enormous administrative responsibility by specializing in the study of Mark Twain. Now, they go all the way around the department, and you have the... Who's running another great organization over here, two or three blocks? A chemist. A chemist. Administration? That's chemistry? And so all the way around the university. Isn't this peculiar? We haven't had an idea since Rome. Isn't this odd? In my own little way, I'm responsible right now for writing a report of a project I've been conducting for several years on a grant. And I learned about administration from being in our culture. And so I have discovered, after carrying on this operation for several years, that what I'm going to do if I get another one, I'm not going to have a supervisor who is a speech pathologist. What's he do as a supervisor? This is ridiculous, to have a highly trained speech pathologist doing what? Operating as a file clerk. He's filing papers, filing reports. He's keeping track of dates and numbers of items and where things are kept and who's using them now. And when have they brought them back yet? And making out schedules and calling people on the phone to see why aren't they here? Are they sick? This you get a doctor's degree for? But that's the way we do it all over the country. What you need is an administrator. Well, part of the problem we have in these communication networks that we call organizations is that we have essentially untrained people running them. They're very intelligent people, but this isn't what they were prepared to do. And so they simply don't do it very well. That is, there's inefficiency here in the use of personnel and the facilities. There's inefficiency in applying the resources of the institution to problems. The great Dean Seashore, who was here for half a century, and one of the greatest men I ever knew, used to say often,
that there is no human problem that can be solved within the confines of any one academic department. But if you encourage the departmentalism, you encourage departments to take on more than they can do, to take on problems which really tend to slop over the edges of their department, pardon the expression, and but they're department proud, and so they don't try to work with. If someone is working on the problem of, let's say, delinquency, what department do you do this in? Well, obviously, no one department does this. But one department might attempt to. And so, again, there's waste and inefficiency. There is effect on individuals that I think is very, very unfortunate. It tends to develop a kind of self-provincialism, provincialism of the self, a tunnel vision, preoccupation with a very small segment of what there is to be concerned with in relation to any significant problem. Specialization tends to be non-functional, is encouraged by this kind of departmentalism. I'm talking about communication networks. If you can keep people in different parts of an organization communicating with each other, then these things I'm talking about tend to be minimized. These are the things that arise when people get isolated from each other and begin to do things without adequate communication. Each individual tends to end up actually communicating with fewer and fewer people and about fewer and fewer matters as he becomes more and more identified with a single department or organizational unit. There are counter agents to all this, but it's 22 minutes after 4. I'll see you Wednesday.